From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. And this is my friend, the comedian, Raleigh Williams.
Exxon is an oil company, okay? They sell oil. They love oil. They've even donated millions of gallons to the world's oceans multiple times. They love oil, okay? They'll try to f*** around every once in a while with, like, algae, and then they'll shut it down because they like doing oil. Oil is their bread and butter, okay? And now I'm hungry. F*** it. Here we go.
Raleigh is the host and creator of Climate Town, where he does comedy about the climate crisis. And that's not everybody's thing. And not just because Raleigh dropped so many F-bombs that it was hard to find a suitable clip of his stand-up for a public radio station whose audience includes three-quarters of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. No, the thing about climate crisis comedy is that a lot of people who deeply care about our future, recognize that this is an existential threat that is already claiming human lives and pushing plants and animals toward and over the edge of extinction. And they just don't think there's anything funny about that. But Aaron Sachs says it's not just okay to laugh at this situation. It's important. And in his latest book, which is called Stay Cool, he argues that humor helps us cultivate endurance, persistence, and solidarity, all of which we're going to need in the long fight against the powers most responsible for polluting our world with greenhouse gases. Aaron Sachs graduated from Harvard. He got his PhD at Yale. He now teaches at Cornell, so it's been a slow and steady crawl to the bottom of the barrel, which is why it's not surprising to find him now slumming it here with us at Utah Public Radio. Aaron Sachs, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Aaron, a few weeks ago, I found my way to Patton Oswalt's comedy special, Annihilation, which is primarily about the death of his wife. And it was, I think this was like the funniest and most heartfelt thing I've ever seen. And I know you're a fan of Tig Notaro, whose most legendary stand-up act is the brutally honest one she did just 4 days after her cancer diagnosis. Sometimes comedy just works really well when it's set up against despondency.
Yeah, I think actually I was just watching Sarah Silverman's latest special, which is largely about the death of her parents. So yeah, comedians are feeling pretty morbid right now, I think. But there's a long tradition that they're following. And I certainly grew up with that morbid sense of humor. I have come from a Jewish background. Probably the thing that influenced my worldview most keenly was watching the movie version of Fiddler on the Roof over and over again when I was in elementary school. It's this great story about how Jewish weddings get interrupted by pogroms and then everybody has to leave the town and that sort of thing. They have a sense of humor about it. They're like, okay, we'll go to the next town and see if we can survive there.
The Jewish comedian Robert Clay, who older American audiences will know from Hogan's Heroes, was a tattoo-carrying survivor of the Buchenwald concentration camp. And he said many times that making people laugh during the Holocaust saved his life.
Yeah, I mean, so I talk about these things a lot with various people. That's the thing that younger people find most surprising. What? There was comedy in the concentration camps? That doesn't make any sense to them.
You have a concentration camp joke in your book, right?
Oh, I have a few.
Yeah. There's one about don't gain too much weight.
Yeah, because we're the ones who are going to have to carry your body out of here.
Ooh, man.
Which was, yeah, I mean, like very, very dark because they weren't really getting much to eat in the first place. Prisoners in concentration camps held cabarets and circuses. And it was like vaudeville up in there. It's really important to think about that and realize what an amazing coping strategy or even survival strategy comedy can be.
There is often a too soon risk to comedy that exists on the edge of tragedy. But global warming isn't new, and it is going to be with us for a long time. So can we put away this notion that it's too soon?
Absolutely, I think so. I try to be cautious about this point because there are circumstances where comedy doesn't work. I've seen it come up, I think, especially with cancer. You know, you mentioned the Tig Notaro bit, which I think is amazing when she's talking about her own cancer. It's quite shocking to the audience at first, but she sort of leans into it and realizes that, you know, it's like they get shocked, they're upset, and then she tries to make them feel better. better, and that makes her feel better, and it all starts working really well. But if you casually make a cancer joke in your day-to-day life, and there happens to be somebody there who just got diagnosed with cancer or who just lost their best friend to cancer, I mean, comedy can go really wrong and can be offensive. But I think you're absolutely right with regard to climate change. We are in it. We're way beyond too soon. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to write this book in the end is that I thought we changed from a situation where we had to communicate that climate change was happening and convince people that, you know, this is important and we need to do something about it. Most people, with the exception of a few very rich, powerful Republicans, have accepted that climate change is real and we need to do something about it. Now the problem is that everybody's really depressed about that. So yeah. We need some way of boosting our morale, because if you have no morale, it's really hard to take action.
Yeah, this is the central thesis, I think, of your book. It's not just that humor helps us cope, which is an important element of it. But as I read it, at least, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you're arguing that this is an essential tactic for building and maintaining morale, which is what we are going to need because this is going to be a very long fight.
Yeah, it's kind of like activation energy. And a big part of this project for me was just looking at the history of comedy. And one of the things I realized in studying that history is that comedy has often been used to build solidarity, to create a stronger sense of community. Like, hey, you know, we are all in this together. In a way, that's where the morbid sense of humor comes in. Like, you know, we're all going to die. We all deal with death in our lives. We need to come to grips with that. And if we can do that together, if it's a shared sense of loss and grief, then we're much more likely to be able to feel some sense of resilience, come back from that, and in this case, do something about the problem.
One of the essential dangers, I think, of comedy about climate change is that so much American humor for so long has been about comeuppance. Mm. We see this increasingly, I think, with jokes about flooding in Florida, many of which rest on this presumption that at some level, anyone who decides to live in Florida sort of deserves what they get. But here's the thing, and this is the challenge with this thing, is very few of us are doing everything we can to play our part. There's always something else that we could have done that we didn't do. And so there is also this level of hypocrisy that undercuts the ability to land those punchlines.
Yeah, and I think that's inevitable. But you can use hypocrisy to your advantage if you understand comedy, right? I mean, if you direct some of the comedy toward yourself, and this is one of the most important innovations in stand-up comedy that really happened in the 50s in the United States, completely transformed what stand-up comedy was. You know, it used to be very vaudeville-like with sort of canned punchlines and rim shots and things like that. And anybody could deliver those jokes in the end. You just copied other people's material. But then stand-up comedy got very, very personal, and that's what allowed it to innovate and become political. One of my favorite comedians who did this beautifully was Phyllis Diller, who was very big in the 1950s and 60s. And the way she said it was, I start with self-denigration, and then I go on to denigrate everybody else. It's a great way to criticize people if you just start by criticizing yourself. You become relatable. You make it clear that you're not up on a high horse. You're in the same boat, but still, there's something here that has to be made fun of. And that was actually one of the other reasons I got drawn to comedy. Because I used to give a lot of talks about climate change, and I was so careful not to, you know, it's like I tried to know my audience. I didn't want to offend anybody. I didn't want to pretend that, like, I'm better than you and you're the problem. And one time somebody came up to me after one of those talks and said, you are criticizing SUVs and their horrible gas mileage and the structural reasons for why SUVs became popular. But can't you just actually criticize the people who drive SUVs? Don't you need to be able to do that? I realized, okay, if we do it in a funny way, and first, if I make fun of myself, then maybe actually I could directly criticize SUV drivers. Then I started saying, like, I came here to give this talk driving my Prius. It's a great car. I only need to use one hand on the steering wheel, which frees up my other hand to pat myself on the back for driving a Prius. And then I could go on. comedians came up with a really good system, I think.
So in addition to Diller, you also write about Dick Gregory, who did this, you know, at a level of perfection that has seldom been matched since. This is the comedian and social activist who was really brilliant at integrating the civil rights movement into his comedy. And he once said, "I've got to make jokes about myself before I can make jokes about them and their society. That way they can't hate me." And I gather that you think that the climate activism movement hasn't perfected the first part of that. We're still at the looking around and trying to point fingers at other people to blame. And if we sort of take that on ourselves initially, it breaks the ice a little more.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning Dick Gregory. I mean, he really was the sort of epitome of somebody who could do comedy and political activism simultaneously. It's not easy. But yeah, a lot of it was by using that trick of directing some of the comedy at himself. And that also speaks to some of the success of the civil rights movement and many other social movements that have used comedy to just, again, create solidarity, bring people into the fold, make it clear that we all have common ground here. Environmentalists have not been good at doing that traditionally. It started as a fairly elite movement, and it tended to have a kind of grim and sanctimonious tone as early as John Muir protecting the national parks in the late 19th century when the Sierra Club was founded, I think 1892. It was basically like, hey, we need to protect these beautiful places so the cultured white elite can enjoy them.
Muir could have been and should have been hilarious because he was a cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, all of those guys, like Edward Abbey was a cartoon, you know, I mean, like,
yeah.
Serious, beautifully philosophical people, and also you could draw them in four strokes. That's funny.
It's true. And to give Edward Abbey some credit, he did have some funny lines in his writing. But yeah, I mean, environmentalists have really tended to take themselves quite seriously. Although another exception to that is Henry David Thoreau, who actually was hilarious.
And knew what he was doing was hilarious.
Yeah. It's that level of self-consciousness that is so important and helpful in communicating your message.
And this isn't to say that that work isn't important. Like, you still teach Silent Spring, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Every year.
Which is not a funny book at all.
No. Yeah, I mean, I've always tried to argue comedy is just another important tool in our toolkit. Comedy alone is not going to save the world. And there is no more important environmental writer than Rachel Carson. She was amazing. It's just that, in a way, she set out to terrify people about the fact that pesticides were now, and this was 1962, pesticides are now everywhere in every single ecosystem and in your body, in your salad bowl. And when you set out to terrify people, then people wind up terrified. And that's also not a really good place for acting. There's been a lot of immobilization that has come from even the best efforts at educating people about environmental problems. Sometimes it's just like, oh, wow, I guess there's nothing we can do.
I feel this a lot in the microplastics conversation right now.
Yeah.
Where people go, well, it's everywhere. It's in my brain. What can I do? Is there a case to be made that if more of the early environmentalists had been easier to read, if it didn't seem like some strange form of secular penance to consume their stories, that more people today might think of themselves as environmentalists?
I mean, we can't change that history. It's impossible to know. And again, I'm really grateful for the writings of people like Rachel Carson and John Muir and his activism, and people like Aldo Leopold, one of the most important ecologists of the 20th century. But in any genre, if we're talking about environmental writing or nature writing, I think it's good to stay flexible. It's good to have a number of different tones, a number of different techniques. And again, comedy is a great tool that can be interjected in anything. Again, when I was studying comedy to write this book, I made a point of trying to sample all different kinds of comedy. And I was thinking about how much I have always loved Shakespeare, and I started reading the comedies. And then I was like, wait a minute, some of the funniest lines in Shakespeare are in the histories. You know, the character of Falstaff is one of the greatest, funniest characters of all time. And even in the tragedies, there's comic relief. So it just really hit me when I was rereading a bunch of Shakespeare plays that, like, you can use this in lots of different contexts. It's a weird and flexible tool that deserves to be deployed, I think, especially in the darkest times.
You've written that at terrifying people, then people wind up terrified. The flip side of that, I think, is that if you're good at making people have a good time, even in the face of terrifying things, then people are going to be willing to dig in with you.
Yeah, that's the hope. And again, I always feel like needing to qualify this because comedy works differently for different people and at different times. And
sure,
there certainly are times when dark comedy can leave people feeling just as immobilized as before. Gallows humor is one of the types of comedy that I talk about a fair amount in the book. And if you're literally on the gallows, or I'm thinking about the great Monty Python scene where there are 23 people strung up on crucifixes singing, "Always look on the bright side of life," they're not going to save themselves by being funny. But if there's anybody there to witness this scene, it can change their mood and their thinking about what's going on here. And if you're feeling a little bit lighter instead of somber and heavy all the time, then for most people, that does lead to more of a capacity to take action. It's at least a possible spark in a way that tragedy usually isn't.
I think we are mired in another way, and you reference this in your book as well. We have somehow decided that our most important job in the climate movement is combating climate change denialism, which you point out is a pretty endless and winless battle that actually pits the vast majority of scientists and everyone else against a very small and shrinking number of people. Yeah. And this very humorless debate takes a lot of oxygen out of the room that could be better used in other ways.
You described it as impossible to win, and maybe we can't get everyone, but I do think most people are now fully aware of the depth of the problem. The bigger problem now feels like everybody's just overwhelmed. Being a professor, I'm sure you encountered this as well. We older people look to the younger generation for energy and enthusiasm, new ideas. And this generation of young people is incredibly depressed. They've been through a global pandemic. They've had the cloud of climate change hanging over them for their entire lives. Now there's AI, which is upending a lot of things, but especially the job market for college grads. It is tough out there. And as many people have noted, the political system in this country is completely broken. It's in many ways a mental health crisis. Comedy is not going to solve it. It's not going to completely cure what ails us, but it can be really helpful. And I say that as somebody who has dealt with my own times of depression caused both by personal and political issues. It helps, you know, it can snap you out of that immediate feeling of despair and just get you to a different place from which you might be able to go on with your day in a more productive way.
There is a great single syllable word that has been helping your people cope for a very long time. You write about this in the book. I'm wondering if you can give a little tutorial on the use of the word oi.
Oi. Yeah, I mean, for me, Jewish humor, it has sustained me in so many ways, and I can certainly talk about that more. I also do want to make the point that the book also has a long section on African-American humor, and it was important to me to sort of juxtapose those two incredible cultural traditions, which haven't always gotten along with each other, but have a huge amount in common, including comedic traditions. And that word oi in the Jewish tradition can be used in so many different ways, but it calls to mind a joke about an old Jewish man who's sitting in a waiting room, and every 30 seconds or so, he says, "Oi, am I thirsty?" And it's so annoying to everybody around. Finally, the person behind the desk in this reception area gets him a glass of water, stomps over to him, slams down the glass of water, and then stomps away. And he looks at the water water, drinks it all down, and in about 30 seconds, he goes, "Boy, was I thirsty." It's just a way of saying, no matter how good it might get, we still live in a veil of suffering and sorrow. And that's just the nature of the world. And we better be used to that and have a way of sort of venting our frustration with that.
One of the things that we've often suspected is most preventative of climate action is this sort of slow crawling nature of climate change. The fact that climate extremes press up against natural variability in ways that make it easy to say, well, we've survived stuff like this before. But I suppose you could say that science is winning the battle of hearts and minds, and that younger generations do know what's coming. This is sort of a perverse sort of win, because we've done such a good job at convincing them that climate change is real and really scary, that they are often suffering from a sort of pre-traumatic stress disorder, which I learned from your book. I did not know this is a term that was first invented satirically in The Onion.
Yes. Yes.
But you've noted that you think the coming generation is also getting particularly good at the gallows humor thing.
Yeah. You know, there was a sign at a climate rally from a young person saying, "I was hoping for a cooler death." I was saying before that the current young generation is depressed. I also do think that they have a sense of humor about it. And now I think climate comedy is going like gangbusters. There's a lot of it out there. It's now being embraced in the culture as something we can do.
This is a book about humor that absolutely has some funny parts, but it really is a scholarly examination of humor, which is itself sort of a funny thing. How did you balance this strange thing of trying to make it funny and also trying to make it a serious book about why it's important to be funny, which can be funny or not funny itself?
As a scholar, I've read a lot of dry scholarship, and I thought there could be nothing worse than an unfunny book about comedy. So part of my preparation for writing this was just thinking about what it means to be funny in writing. And, you know, I thought of the whole thing as sort of a fun improvisational experiment. There were times when I was writing when a joke would occur to me, something that I had read or something that I had thought of myself. And I allowed myself to write that into the text, even right after I was making some sort of scholarly argument, let's say, and just see what happened. And it was really fun. You know, some of those got cut, some of those stayed in. And ultimately, I hope it's a reading experience that offers some variety, so that there are serious moments and then there's some comic relief. And there's just a general sense of playfulness and also solidarity. Like, again, we are in this together. Let's have some fun together and also be thoughtful together.
Your coming book has the very earnest title, "The Earth Is Ours, Not Mine: A History of Environmental Justice." Am I going to be cracking up when I read this one?
Not as much. Writing this book, Stay Cool, was really, really helpful to me in so many ways. It made me think about everything that I write in a slightly different lens. There are far fewer comedic moments in the environmental justice, but there are some, and I hope those will provide the right amount of comic relief, even as the book tries to fairly quickly and lightly cover about 500 years of ideas about environmental justice.
Do people expect you to be funny? Is it like the scene from Finding Nemo where they're like, "Hey, you're a clownfish"?
Yeah, a little bit. For friends and family who have known me for a long time, this was a really surprising twist in my career and in my life. I even did stand-up comedy at open mic nights, and it was really, really fun. And I invited a bunch of friends and family, and they just could not believe it was happening, but they went along with it and were very supportive, and I'm very grateful to them. And I think we all had a great time. It's something that many people can benefit from in all kinds of different ways. Comedy can really make a difference in people's lives. And then one step beyond that is it can really make a difference in the world.
That's Aaron Sachs. He's a historian and an American studies scholar, and he really wants you to laugh just a little bit more about the greatest catastrophe in the history of our planet. Aaron Sachs, thank you.
Thanks for having me. This was a pleasure.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you're not in Utah, you can still listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcast. Public radio stations around the country have had a substantial cut to funding. So now, more than ever, it's important to support this work if you are able. You can do that at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Maxim Dorian. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Dassault. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.